We hope you enjoy this recording of a live broadcast brought to you by Torah in Motion. For more learning opportunities, please visit www.torahinmotion.org.
Okay, 9:17, daylight savings time. Shh. I think this is the first time ever Purim is going to be in daylight savings time. That means, you know, an extra hour of fasting and feasting. Depends where you stay. Okay. Welcome, everybody. It's a pleasure to introduce Rebecca Winter. I think everybody in the room knows who she is, but I really think, just to highlight Mikzvah Tracha, you know, first of all, as far as Torah in Motion is concerned, we were really introduced to her when she taught the first time we ran our mother and daughter our bat mitzvah program. She taught the program and did a wonderful job a few years ago. She's, of course, a graduate of Olpana, is presently at Stern in the Yeshiva University, the women's graduate program in Talmud. She learned at Lindenbaum, Midrash at Lindenbaum in Israel. And she was the Canadian representative for the Chidon HaTanach. And she taught the Chidon where my three older kids are right now in Netivot taking the Chidon HaTanach. And really, it's a pleasure to have her as a guest speaker, if we can call her that. And she'll be giving our first session on Divrei Hayamim. Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi Kalman. Okay. Hi. Thank you all for coming to this first early morning session, especially because it feels like it's 8 o'clock in the morning. I'm Rebecca Winter, and thank you all for coming. Good morning. And today, you've come to this first session. As you see, this today's talk is going to be about Sefer Divrei Hayamim. And Sefer Divrei Hayamim is, to me at least, one of a very, very kind of obscure and strange book in Tanakh. It's the last Sefer that we have in Tanakh. And the first time that I read Divrei Hayamim, at least, it was very strange to me because, as you may know, the bulk of Sefer Divrei Hayamim is really just repeating many of the stories in Sefer Melachim, in the Book of Kings. And many of the stories also in Sefer Shmuel Beth. And this seems very strange because we have this entire Sefer that just seems to be a complete repetition of the same stories that we already have from Yirmiyahu, who wrote Sefer Melachim. And in my mind, at least, the first time that I was reading Divrei Hayamim, this seemed very strange to me. What is the purpose of Divrei Hayamim, really, if it just seems to be a complete repetition of the books of Sefer Melachim? So today I want to try to examine with you and try to figure out what the overall purpose, how should we as readers of Sefer Divrei Hayamim approach the Sefer? What should our approach be to Sefer Divrei Hayamim? And before we really understand that, I think we just need to take a step back for a second and realize that Sefer Divrei Hayamim was written by Ezra and Nehemiah, and Sefer Melachim was written by Yirmiyahu. And Sefer Divrei Hayamim by Ezra and Nehemiah was probably written around the times of Binyan Bayit Sheni, the building of the Second Temple, which was probably around 516 BCE when it was completed. And Sefer Melachim was written around the Churban of Bayit Rishon, the destruction of the first temple, which was, as we know, 586 BCE. So they're not really written at such drastically different times in terms of the amount of years that happened between them. But the way that we should really be looking at Sefer Divrei Hayamim and Sefer Melachim, according to Chazal, is that both of them are written through Nevuah. We have a machloket among Chazal. According to the Rambam, really, there's kind of a hierarchy among the Nevi'im, and Sefer Melachim is maybe more holy in a way than Sefer Divrei Hayamim, because Divrei Hayamim was written further down the line in a different time period later on. But really, many of the Parshanim, many of Chazal do say that actually we shouldn't be viewing them as in a hierarchical way, that Sefer Melachim is more important than Sefer Divrei, not more important, but holier in a way, or has more Kedusha than Sefer Divrei HaYamim, but we should really be looking at it in a way that they're really on the same level. They were both written through Nevuah. So I just want to say that as we approach Sefer Divrei HaYamim, we have to written that it was written, we have to view it as it was written through Nevuah by Ezra and Nehemiah. And before we can really understand what's going on in Sefer Divrei HaYamim and its purpose and how it uses the stories in Sefer Melachim, I think we just have to take a look at Sefer Melachim, a quick overview of Sefer Melachim, if you will, so that we can understand how Sefer Melachim was written and kind of its main purpose or its main themes. So I'll just tell you briefly. Sefer Melachim, really, if we take a step back and look at it, we can see that there were really three overall tragedies that happen in Sefer Melachim, three terrible things that happen that Yirmiyahu outlines for us. And those three things are, the first thing being the split in the Melucha, the split of the kingdom, where Malchei Yisrael and Malchei Yehuda reigned separately throughout Sefer Melachim. The second tragedy happened as Galut Ashur, the exile of the northern Israeli tribes, the Israelite tribes, to Assyria, and also joined with that the destruction of Shomron, their main city. And the third tragedy that happened is the Galut Bavel. As we know, the tribes of Binyamin and Yehuda were exiled to Bavel, along with the destruction of the first temple, Churban Bayit Rishon. Those are kind of the three tragedies, the three devastations that we see happening in Sefer Melachim overall. And the way that Yirmiyahu writes Sefer Melachim, he really directly places the blame of these three tragedies on three of the kings of Yisrael and Yehuda. The first tragedy, the split in the Melucha, is directly linked, and the blame is placed on Shlomo HaMelech. Shlomo HaMelech, who in Sefer Melachim is portrayed as marrying outside of the faith, marrying, namely, starting with Bat Para, and then marrying outside of the faith to many, many other women, who eventually lead him down this path of Avodah Zarah. And because of that, he is blamed for this division in the Melucha, this division in the kingdom. The second tragedy, the Galut Ashur, is linked directly to Yeravam ben Nevat, Yeravam being the first king of Malchei Yisrael. And because of him, and because he again brought all of this Avodah Zarah to Bnei Yisrael, he is blamed for their eventual exile to Ashur. And the third tragedy, the Churban Bayit Rishon and the exile to Bavel, is related and linked directly to Menashe HaMelech. Menashe was one of the worst kings of Yehuda. He was also in Melachim cited as bringing the worst kinds of Avodah Zarah, namely, especially Molech, which is sacrificing your own children. Terrible, terrible man. And because of him, in Melachim, he is directly linked to the destruction of the first temple, to Churban Bayit Rishon. So those are the three main major events, I would say. Many other things happen in Melachim too. But those are the three major events that happen in Sefer Melachim. And Yirmiyahu directly places the blame of those three events on the kings of Yisrael and Yehuda, and subsequently then on the followers of the kings, who are us, Bnei Yisrael. Sefer Divrei HaYamim is told from a very, very different perspective, and I want to now look with you at three separate examples of how Sefer Divrei HaYamim differs from Sefer Melachim, and through those examples, hopefully, we'll be able to gain a perspective and understand how we're supposed to read Sefer Divrei HaYamim in a different way, that we read the same exact stories that appear in Sefer Melachim. So why don't we look at the first example together in Source 1. This example is I'm bringing an example of a very, very, very small and seemingly insignificant detail about something that happened in Sefer Melachim and then is repeated in Sefer Divrei HaYamim. But I think it's through this tiny and seemingly minor example that we can kind of gain a different perspective. So this example that I'm going to bring is the story that we're going to just read about briefly. talked about Hiram Melech Tzur, Hiram who's the king of Tzur, and at the time Shlomo HaMelech is building the Beit HaMikdash, and Shlomo needs a craftsman to help him out with the building of the Beit HaMikdash, so he asks his friend Hiram Melech Tzur, who his father David also dealt with, and Hiram Melech Tzur has the perfect man, whose name also happens to be Hiram, not to make it even more confusing, but there are two Hirams, not to be confused with each other. And Hiram, or Horam, as he's kind of called in Divrei HaYamim, is the person who we're going to be looking at right now. So source 1 in Chronicles 2, chapter 2. Va'ata shalachti ish chacham yodea bina v'choram avi. Ben isha min b'not dan v'aviv ish tzori. So we have this man, Hiram, who I just talked about, who's going to be the craftsman that Hiram Melech Tzur, who's speaking, is going to be sending to Shlomo. And what's his lineage? He is the son of and his mother is from Shevet Dan. And his father is an Ish Tzuri. His father lives in Tzur. Okay, so that's his family, very nice. At least his mother is Jewish. And she's from Dan, and he's going to help out and build the Beit HaMikdash. The exact same person, Hiram from Tzur, we meet also in Sefer Melachim, and let's see how they describe him there. In Kings 1, chapter 7. Vayishlach HaMelech Shlomo vayikach et Hiram mitzor. And what's his lineage? Ben Ishal Manahu mimateh Naphtali. Vaviv ish Tzuri. Right? In Melachim, the exact same event, but this time his mother is from Naphtali. Right? It's a seemingly insignificant point where his mother is from, but it's nonetheless a very, very glaring contradiction that we have, a huge difference that we have between Sefer Melachim and Sefer Divrei HaYamim. And of course, we're all wondering, well, where exactly is his mother from? I mean, it shouldn't be that hard to figure out. Is she from Shevet Dan, or is she from Shevet Naphtali? And many of the Parshanim they all jump on this point, and they're trying to figure out, well, what actually happened? Where is his mother from? And I brought you one Parshan, the Radak, who talks about this exact question, and we'll read to you how he tries to reconcile the two. U'b'melachim ben ishal manahu. And Radak asks the same question, ben ishal manahu mimateh Naphtali. And Radak asks the exact same question. In Melachim, it says she's from Shevet Naphtali. So, what's his answer? Aviv hayami mateh Naphtali. Really, his father was from Naphtali. V'karu tzori lefi shegar b'tzor. And the reason that it says he's a tzori, the reason it says his father is from Tzor, is because he lives in Tzor. But really, the father, when it talks about in Melachim that his mother is from Naphtali, what it really means is that his father is from Naphtali. And that's how the Radak tries to reconcile these two. And really, it's a little bit difficult to read it into the Pshat, but if you look at the Pasuk going back to Melachim, to the Pasuk in Melachim, we can kind of change the grammar a little bit so that it reads, Ben Isha Amana, Hu Mimateh Naphtali V'aviv Ish Tzuri. So he is from the tribe of Naphtali, going by through his father's lineage, and his father is an Ish Tzuri, because he lives in Tzur. I mean, it's a little bit difficult to kind of fit in, but there are other explanations also. We have one Parshan who says, well, it's not really a Melachim. It's not talking about his mother. It's talking about his grandmother. And the Malbim is so bothered by all of this that he says, forget this whole thing. Really, there were two different Hiram from Tzur's, and one of them was working on the Beit HaMikdash, and he died. And it happened to be that the other guy who they got to fill his place was also named Hiram. Meaning the Parshanim, they don't really know how to reconcile this. So they're trying to find ways, and there are ways that you can kind of reconcile the two. But I think that really, and Rabbi Chaim Angel also points out, that really we're not asking the most interesting and most relevant question to solve this reconciliation, right? It doesn't really matter what exactly happened. I mean, we can kind of reconcile those two through all these ways that I mentioned through the Parshanim. What we should be really interested in approaching Sefer Divrei HaYamim, is why. Why does Sefer Divrei HaYamim decide to write that Hiram's mother is from Dan? Why it doesn't Sefer Divrei HaYamim agree with Sefer Melachim on this very, very minor point? Not what actually happened, but why does Divrei HaYamim decide to record it this way? And that's the question that we're supposed, that's how we should really be approaching Divrei Hayamim. How come? Why are these changes important? And I think for this particular change, if you can all turn your page to Shmot Perek Lamed Aleph, I think that we can kind of understand why this is happening, why Divrei Hayamim decides to record it in this way, by simply looking at the psukim in Shmot Lamed Aleph. In Shmot Lamed Aleph, we're encountering Moshe, who's in this case starting to build the Mishkan. And we encounter two different people in this chapter. And we're just going to read these two psukim that are bolded. So, Vayidaber Hashem al Moshe Lemor, and then Pasuk Bet. Re'e karati b'shem Bezalel ben Uri ben Hur l'mate Yehuda. So I've called a builder. I'm going to give you this builder named Bezalel, and he is from the tribe of Yehuda. And then at the very end, Pasuk Vav, Va'ani hine natati ita et ahaliyav ben achi samach l'mate Dan. And I've also given you this craftsman, this ahaliyav, who's going to help you out also, and he is from Shevet Dan. So we have these two people who are building the Mishkan, who are going to be the main guys, our main people in building the Mishkan. One is from Shevet Yehuda, and one is from Shevet Dan. And now, if we go and look back at Divrei Hayamim, at Shlomo HaMelech building the Mishkan, I think we can take a step back and understand what's going on here according to Divrei Hayamim. In building the Beit HaMikdash, we have two instrumental people as well. We have Shlomo HaMelech, who's from Shevet Yehuda, and he's our main builder. And then we have his craftsman, who's going to work alongside of him, and he's Chiram, and he is from Shevet Dan. Divrei Hayamim is trying very hard, even in the most minor detail, down to the last drop, to try to link the building of the Beit HaMikdash to the divine building of the Mishkan that we have all the way back in Sefer Shmot. There has to be some kind of link in Divrei Hayamim. Yirmiyahu, who we talked about before, who wrote Sefer Melachim from a much more negative and maybe even cynical perspective. He's not really so interested in making this direct link from the Mishkan to the Beit HaMikdash. So for him, it's not that important. The mother's from Dan, the mother's from Naphtali, whatever it is, we can kind of, maybe it's the grandmother, maybe it's the father, whatever it is. But Sefer Divrei Hayamim is very interested in this lineage. It wants to make a specific point. Just like the Mishkan was built by somebody from Yehuda and somebody from Dan, so too the Beit HaMikdash was also built by somebody from Yehuda and somebody from Shevet Dan. And I think with this perspective in mind, so this new kind of positive outlook on the same history that Divrei Hayamim seems to put a much more positive perspective and positive way of looking at this same history, we can now look at two more examples and understand what's going on in Divrei Hayamim and then figure out why Divrei Hayamim is doing this. Okay? So our second example that we have is, as I said, Shlomo HaMelech married outside the faith. He married Bat Paro. And in Sefer Melachim, this is portrayed as what eventually leads to the split in the Melucha, the division between the two kingdoms. And let's see how Divrei Hayamim deals with this very same thing. So the psukim we're going to read now are the only psukim in Divrei Hayamim that talk about Shlomo marrying Bat Paro at all. In fact, they're the only two psukim that talk about Shlomo marrying outside the faith at all in Divrei Hayamim. So let's see how Divrei Hayamim deals with this. Chronicles 2, chapter 8. That Bat Paro ha'ela Shlomo me'ir David labait asher banala, ki amar lo teshev ishali bevet David melech Yisrael, ki kodesh hema asher ba'alem aron Hashem. So he takes Bat Paro, who seems to be his wife, and he's taking her out of Ir David, out of the house of David. Why? Because the house of David was a holy place where David once took the Aron of Hashem to, and he doesn't want his wives to be around there. Right? So he does it for this really holy and very godly reason. He's taking Bat Paro, who we assume is his wife, because in Divrei Hayamim it doesn't talk about her otherwise, and he's taking her out to a different place to move her to a new palace because he doesn't want her in this holy place. It seems like a great reason. And then if you read the pasuk following that, Yudbet, אז העלה שלמה עולות להשם על מזבח השם אשר בנה לפני העולם. And then, don't you think that Baparo had any negative effect or there was any negativity associated with this at all? No, no. After this, Shlomo went and he was zoveach lahashem and he did all these great things and he was always had this beautiful connection to Hashem. That's how Divrei HaYamim portrays Baparo and Shlomo's intermarriages, really. Now let's look at Sefer Melachim. I already told you what happens, but you can see it inside as well. Okay, so Kings 1, chapter 9, says Sefer Melachim about the exact same event. Ach bat paro alta meir David el beta asher banala ad banala et hamila. And he takes bat paro, the same thing that we just talked about in Divrei HaYamim, he takes bat paro and he moves her to a different place. But there's no mention of the reason, why does he move her? It seems really that he's moving her because she's getting an upgrade. He built her a new palace, and now it's time for her to move to the new palace. Amazing, right? There's no mention of these lofty reasons that we read about in the same story in Divrei HaYamim. And then if we continue to read about Shlomo and his wives, in Perek Yod Aleph, the next source, V'hamelach Shlomo ahav nashim nochriyot rabot ve'et bat paro. So Shlomo loved all of these foreign women, and especially to mention bat paro, Moaviyot, Ammoniyot, Adomiyot, Stoniyot, and Chitiyot. And v'yihi le'et ziknat Shlomo nashav hitu et levavo acharei Elokim acherim v'lo haya levavo shalemim Hashem Elokav kilvav David avi. And because of his wives eventually turned him away, and they led him astray, and he did all this avodah zarah, and that's what led to this division in the Melucha. So an event that is viewed in Sefer Melachim as so, so negative and so detrimental on Shlomo's life, really what leads to this first tragedy in Sefer Melachim, the division of the Melucha, is taken in Sefer Divrei HaYamim and turned almost into a positive event. Shlomo taking Bat Paro and moving her out for a very holy and beautiful reason. It's unbelievable, really. It's the exact same event with two different perspectives. Yes? Pardon? Ah, okay, so we just mentioned before that Sefer Melachim was written by Yirmiyahu, and Sefer Divrei HaYamim was written by Ezra and Nehemiah during the times of the building of the Second Temple.
Also, you have in Divrei HaYamim, Ha'ela Shlomo, he did it, and in Melachim, it says, Alta, she is on her own, so to speak, reinforcing what you said.
Uh-huh. Right, that she on her own is moving out to a greater place to live, yeah. She's excited about the upgrade that she's getting.
She's Bat Paro. This is a great feat for him as a king.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but Malachi doesn't look at it.
Right. Yeah.
Political moves on Solomon's part as opposed to, it says here that he actually loved her.
Right.
For sure.
And he had a lot of strong ties with nations from outside, and it was for sure very good for him politically. But at the same time, we see that it wasn't, the Tanakh tells us specifically that it wasn't just a political move. And that pasuk about how he loves these women, he loves these, especially these Nashim Nachriyot, it kind of gives us a hint that it wasn't only for political reasons. Okay? At least according to Sefer Melachim, for sure. With all these wives, it's a good question. Okay, so I think the message is clear from this example, at least, that Divrei HaYamim takes a much more positive perspective about a same event in history, just as our previous example. The last example we're going to look at is also talking about one of the kings that we mentioned before, Melech Menashe, the king Menashe, who, as we said, was one of the worst kings in Yehuda. And he is deemed as responsible for the destruction of the first temple. And I think that before we look at this example, I want to just say that Divrei HaYamim does talk about negative things that happen to the kings, right? The way that Divrei HaYamim portrays Menashe, they portray Menashe in still an extremely negative light. It doesn't always shy away from all the terrible things. But let's look at the way that Divrei HaYamim ends off the story of Menashe versus the way that Sefer Melachim does. So we'll look in Source 3 together, in Chronicles chapter Lama Gimel 33. Vayaveh Hashem alehem et sarei hatzava asher lamelach Ashur, vayilkadu et Menashe b'chuchim, vayasruhu b'nechushatayim, vayalichuhu bavela. So we're looking at the king Menashe after he's done all of these terrible things, and Melech Ashur comes and he captures him and he ties him up and he drags him to Bavel. Ukehatzer lo chila et pnei Hashem elokav, vayichana me'od milifnei Hashem avotav. And when he was in distress, when he was in this terrible state, he then does tshuva. He turns to Hashem and he humbles himself before Hashem. And Pasuk Yud Gimel, Vayit Palelela, Vayater lo, Vayishma Tchinata. And he prays to Hashem, and Hashem hears his prayers, and he gives him, and he grants him this tshuva. Vayashivehu Yerushalayim l'malchuta, and he's brought back to Yerushalayim, and he's reinstated as king. Vayeda Menashe ki Hashem hu ha'elokim. And Menashe knows that Hashem is God. So at the end of his life in Sefer Divrei HaYamim, the end of this horrible king who sacrificed his children, at the end of his life, there seems to be this amazing reversal, and he turns around because probably he's been tied up and he realizes that he has to do something to get himself out of the situation. But regardless of that, he turns around, he does tshuva, and Hashem accepts the tshuva. Now let's look at the same event. All we have really in Sefer Melachim is the way that Sefer Melachim ends off the story of this terrible king Menashe. And right next to it, in Sefer Melachim, Vayater divrei Menashe, v'yater divrei Menashe, v'kol asher asa, v'chatato asher chata, halohem k'tuvim al Sefer divrei ha'amim l'malchei Yehuda. And if you want to know more about Menashe and all the horrible things that he did, we're not going to talk about them now. You can read them separately in a different place. Sefer Melachim does not waste its breath and does not try to even talk about any of the tshuva and Menashe's return to Hashem at all. It completely skips over this seemingly extremely important event in Menashe's life. Once again, this is the same example as all the examples I've been showing you. Sefer Divrei HaYamim takes the same events in history, and even for the worst king, and even for the king that we see as being responsible directly for the Chorban Bayit Rishon, Sefer Divrei HaYamim turns it around for us and shows us that even this worst king, even Menashe HaMelech, was able to do tshuva and was able to return to Hashem successfully. So, yes. Yeah. No. You know what? I'm not sure at all. I've never heard of any extra books or any external books that are written. Maybe they were lost, I think, and we don't really know where they are, where they're written. And there are lots of things like that, as you mentioned, Malchei Yehuda, and also Sefer Divrei Natan Hanavi. Even in Sefer Divrei HaYamim itself, it talks about how, if you want to know more about the story, you can look at another external book. So it doesn't seem like the Sefer and Sefer Melachim is referring to Divrei HaYamim. It's a great question. I'm not sure. It's an interesting possibility, but I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. No. Mm-hmm. That we'll be able to fill in some of these details for you. That's a very interesting point. I'm not sure, though, but yeah. Mm-hmm. There are other mentions of it, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's possible. It's an interesting point. Any other? So if anyone wants to make a lot of money, excellent. Great. Yeah. Yehuda. Sidkiyahu came generations after him, a few generations after him, and Sidkiyahu also has a similar story that happened to him. Both of them, yeah. Menashe is before the Korban, and in fact, Menashe, as we see, is still around the times of Ashur, right? Because it's Ashur who takes him to Bavel. So Menashe is still during that time period. And Sidkiyahu is really during the times of the Babylonians themselves, when they were in charge of Eretz Yisrael. It's a good point. So Sidkiyahu, is just to mention, is the last king of Yehuda, and he's the guy who's around during the times of Korban by Risha. And kind of a similar thing happens to him. But we'll leave that for now. Thank you. Okay, so we can now take a step back and we see Divrei HaYamim has, as you said so nicely, a different agenda, takes a very different perspective of the same historical events. And the question is, why? What's going on here? How are we supposed to approach Sefer Divrei HaYamim in a different way that we look at and read and approach Sefer Melachim? And I think the way to really take a look at it, as we said before, Sefer Melachim was written during the times of the Jews who were during Chorban Bayit Rishon. And Yirmiyahu writes Sefer Melachim during that time. And as we said before, Yirmiyahu's agenda, or this perspective that Yirmiyahu has during his time period, especially if you read Sefer Yirmiyahu, you would see that the relationship that Yirmiyahu has with the people is they don't have a great relationship at all during that time period. Bnei Yisrael do not think that they deserve the terrible things that are happening to them. They can't really understand why these atrocities are happening, and really ultimately why Yirmiyahu keeps telling them that Hashem is going to destroy the Beit HaMikdash and exile them all out into the land. So when outside of Eretz Yisrael to Bavel. So when Yirmiyahu writes Sefer Melachim, he's writing it from a perspective of, well, I'll tell you exactly why you are deserving of the Chorban. It's because of all the terrible things you did. Look at your leadership, look at your kings, and look at the way that you acted as a result of your leadership. The country was ridden with Avodah Zarah, ridden with terrible sins. Look at all the things you did. You, Bnei Yisrael, are to blame for the Chorban Bayit Rishon. You are to blame for all of the terrible things that happened. That's what Yirmiyahu is trying to tell the people. Sefer Melachim is about us taking responsibility for the things that we did. Sefer Divrei HaYamim is written at a very, very different time period. Sefer Divrei HaYamim is talking to people who are the Shivat Zion, to the people who are now coming from Bavel and making their way back and returning to Yerushalayim and to Eretz Yisrael, and who are now going to start building the second Beit HaMikdash. Sefer Divrei HaYamim needs to be written from a much more positive perspective, according to Ezra and Nehemiah. If we think about it in this way, Ezra and Nehemiah are dealing with people who are now so guilt-ridden, and they know, they've heard Yirmiyahu's words. They understand that they have done terrible things and that they are to blame. They know that they've sinned and that the Chorban, they feel directly responsible for the Chorban. They know about Sefer Melachim. Now Ezra and Nehemiah need to try to convince these people and get these people to kind of rise up and get up and go back to Eretz Yisrael and continue and rebuild into the same place that they have sinned so terribly, to the exact same place where the Beit HaMikdash once stood, which they were directly responsible for its destruction. But they have to now, despite all of that, go back and rebuild. And for Ezra and Nehemiah, they're trying to tell the people that it's true. We have a very long and terrible history. But there are parts of the history and there are things that we can look at in our history that are positive and that can strengthen us and help us to rebuild the second Beit HaMikdash. Just like the first Beit HaMikdash, we can liken the building of the first Beit HaMikdash to the building of the Mishkan. Just like the worst king in Yehuda, the most terrible king in Yehuda, was in the end did tshuva and he was pardoned for, we too can rise up and we too can take those opportunities and go back to Eretz Yisrael and start rebuilding. And I think that the most obvious example of the difference between the two books is really how, one of the most obvious examples, is really how Yirmiyahu chooses to end Sefer Melachim versus how Ezra and Nehemiah decide to end Divrei Hayamim. Yirmiyahu in Sefer Melachim ends off with the terrible tragedy and the story of Gedaliah ben Achikam. Gedaliah was the last possible leader in Eretz Yisrael. He was instated as the last leader of Eretz Yisrael after Chorban Bayit Rishon, after the destruction of the first temple. Bnei Yisrael still had an opportunity at some semblance of leadership within Eretz Yisrael. Gedaliah was the chosen leader, and we, the people of Bnei Yisrael, rose up and killed him off. And after him, there was no more leadership, no more Jewish leadership in Eretz Yisrael until the times of Ezra and Nehemiah and the building of the Second Temple. And we end off Sefer Melachim with this tragic story that even after the Chorban, Bnei Yisrael still couldn't get it together there in Eretz Yisrael. You still couldn't get it together. You still didn't learn your lesson. Sefer Divrei Hayamim skips over this story of Gedaliah ben Achikam and instead chooses to end off with Hatzarat Koresh, with Koresh telling Bnei Yisrael that they can now return to Eretz Yisrael and start building the second temple. And really, our last pasuk, the last words in the entire Tanakh, the Tanakh ends off with this pasuk, Mi bachem mikol ama Hashem elokav ima vayal. Who among you wants to come, says Koresh, to Bnei Yisrael, should come up and really, vaya'al, really make aliyah, come back to Eretz Yisrael. Vaya'al, you can rise above the past, you can take the past and look at it from a different perspective, you can rise above, you can come back, and you can rebuild. And I think that this way of kind of taking events from the past and looking at them from a different perspective is really the first kind of interpretation that we have of within the Tanakh itself. And I think we, as studiers of the Tanakh, and or our rabbis, or Chazal, or whoever really looks at the Tanakh, really looks at the Tanakh in the very same way. When we look at the Tanakh, we want the Tanakh to be relevant to us, to be relevant to our time period. And that's really what Ezra and Nehemiah are doing. They're doing it through Nevuah, of course, but really it's a very similar mechanism. They are also taking events from the past and interpreting them and taking a different perspective on them, a perspective that can be relevant to the people of their time and to themselves, so that the people of their time can now carry on and rise above. And I think that what Ezra and Nehemiah are giving us is a very important message of really how to make Tanakh relevant in our time. Thank you very much. If you have any questions. Yeah.
How successful was
it? Not many. There were not many, many people who came back. And you know what? I'm not really sure. Does anybody know what percentage of people came back? Very small. We don't know exactly. Very small, yeah. So according to Nevuat Yirmiyahu, it was going to be 70 years. So Chorban Bayit Rishon was 586, and the Second Temple stood from like 516 to the year 70. So between those two was 70 years. But they started to build the temple a little bit before, maybe 530 or 535. So it wasn't that many years, but yeah.
I'm not sure whether that would be reasonable to say for first interpretation, because actually any kind of story that you told, everybody always has an agenda.
Mm-hmm.
If I go home and tell my wife what you were talking about now, I'll probably have different emphasis, different details,
mm-hmm.
whether I have an agenda or whether it's because I have selective memory.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at earlier parts of the Tanakh as well, you could say that a lot of stories in Devarim
mm-hmm.
are a reinterpretation of things which happened in Shemot, when the story of Nimrod
Mm-hmm.
Even the same person telling the story, there's a different audience. But Eliezer,
mm-hmm.
he's going for Rivka.
Mm-hmm.
The story is retold a few times, but there are little differences.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes those differences are because, well, you want to say it this way for this one, and another way for the other one.
Mm-hmm.
So that's
it's true. That's true, but I think that's true. It's a very interesting point.
To see what their agenda was.
Right. Yeah, yes. I understand what you're saying, and that's true. And the Tanakh does that for its own specific purposes, especially from Sefer Bamidbar to Sefer Dvarim. There's kind of a similar way to reconcile those two, as the two Sfarim have different perspectives, really, and as you say, different agendas. But Sefer Dibre HaYamim seems to be the first Sefer that systematically seemed the entire Sefer itself is really, there's nothing really new in the Sefer. It's just taking things from the past and putting them in a new light and putting a new perspective on them. As a systematic Sefer, as a whole corpus, as a whole work itself, Sefer Dvarim has things that are unique about it and different about it and brings new things to light. Sefer Dibre HaYamim doesn't do that at all. As a work and as a book, the entire focus of it is how are we going to look at the past in a slightly different way? And that's kind of what I was saying, that it's that as a book, it's not really telling us anything new historically, but it's telling us something new in terms of how we're supposed to look at the past. But it's a fair point. Thank you. Yeah.
There's something a little troubling because, just like echoing your words, everybody tells things from different perspectives, and that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
What happens when someone's doing it deliberately? Unfortunately, it's reminding me a little bit too much of the sort of communist habit of rewriting history, airbrushing people out of photographs.
Mm-hmm.
And between beginning to fudge facts, because once you start doing that, you don't know where you're going to end. And I'm wondering whether you're at all troubled by this.
It's a good question. A little bit. I mean, for sure the biblical critics, and for sure many of the biblical critics look at Dibre HaYamim and say, as you say, that they, instead of looking at the same event from a different perspective, they say that we're looking at the same event, but they are making up a new story, or they're changing the facts as they were. And I think that as Jews, when we approach the Tanakh, we're not supposed to look at the Tanakh and say, we don't really know in the end what actually happened or what's actually factual. The Tanakh is not there for us as a book of history, as a historical piece, right? In the end of the day, that's really the truth of it. And we have to understand that Ezra and Nehemiah, as I said before, wrote this book through Nevuah, coming from Hashem. And whether or not they got the facts exactly right is, in the end of the day, for us to then change history and for us to then come and change the Tanakh, is dangerous, and that is not something that we should be doing. But as Ezra and Nehemiah, as the book is included in the Tanakh, we have to look at it as, well, what is it coming to tell us? And not so much I care about what really realistically happened, but what I really care about is why did they write it in this way?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The Malachim came first and it told the story, and from what I understood from your talk,
mm-hmm.
Dibre HaYamim came along and retold the story, and therefore Dibre HaYamim are more likely to be the ones who have more of a retelling agenda.
Yes and no. Not necessarily. According to the Rambam, maybe we're supposed to look at Malachim kind of on a higher level, like we're supposed to put them kind of hierarchically. But according to many of Chazal, and really, it is possible to reconcile. Like with Menashe, as we saw, we can say that Malachim left it out purposely, but really it did happen, we could say. I don't know that we're supposed to. It's possible that it was within the Masorah that everybody knew these stories, and the way that Yirmiyahu wrote them, he kind of writes them from his perspective, and then Ezra and Nehemiah come along, they say, you know, there are parts of the stories that we really feel are important and imperative to write down, and to leave out equally so. In Dibre HaYamim, there's no mention of David with Bathsheba, just as there's no mention of Shlomo's sins with his wives, right? Dibre HaYamim also picks and chooses what to leave out and what to put in. And it is possible, really, to reconcile the two. In the case of the Shvatim with the mothers, it's a little bit difficult, as you saw. But yeah. Yeah.
When the decision came to compile the Tanakh, given that we have two stories, two events, mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Why wasn't the positive version, you know, coming right after Shmuel L? Why didn't it fall that way? Is
Well, I think it's just, because Yirmiyahu is the one who wrote Malachi, and chronologically he came first. So the Tanakh is divided, really. We say that Shmuel was written by Shmuel HaNavi, followed by Malachim, who was written by Yirmiyahu. And Yirmiyahu is a Navi that, in history, chronologically, for sure came before Ezra and Nehemiah. Ezra and Nehemiah, who were all the way, way at the end, during the times of Shivat Zion, the building of the Second Temple, their books, Ezra and Nehemiah, also come at the end of Tanakh, right? So it just makes sense to group those all together. That's what I think. Yeah. You know what? I didn't even think of that. I'm not really sure. But it's an interesting thing to look at. I'm not sure. If we look at Sefer Ezra, maybe we can see some direct link again. It's a good point. Any other questions? Yeah.
One quotes the Ibrahim. And fascinating that this is a late discussion.
Mm-hmm.
But the same problem, the problem is certainly there.
Yeah. That's right. Thank you. Thank you. Any other points, comments? Yes.
Just a quick one on Ibrahim. Is it an understudied book?
Understudied book. I mean, I don't know how much people study Tanakh in general, but I would say in school, at least, it's never taught in the high schools, or no.
Does that not seem strange?
I think what happens in high school is that they have this lofty goal of, oh, we're going to go through the whole Nach, and at the end the kids are going to know about Nach. And they start at Shmuel, and then they do Malachim, and then it kind of gets to be too much, and they do a few parts of Yirmiyahu and Yashiyahu, and then it's like, forget it. Ketuvim is a little bit too much. I think it's just because there's so much in Nevi'im and Ketuvim, and they start off with Nevi'im Rishonim because everyone has to know about Yahshua and Shoftim and Shmuel and Malachim, and then at the end of high school it kind of peters out and there's no... It's unfortunate, but yeah.
It would be helpful if in the high school, even if they don't get to keep all of that, they would take your three examples of others and say to the student before they go out, you know, there's more to the Tanakh than what you've studied in intensively. You know, this would be a real plus, I think, for the education of Tanakh.
For sure, I completely agree. We can go and approach the high schools with this new curriculum that we've come up with.
The only people who do the Dibre HaYamim are the people who do the Perek Yomim, maybe.
Yeah.
And then Christians like
They always know their Tanakh, yeah. Yeah, they know. Right. Thank you very much and have a great day.
We hope you found this recording a most enjoyable learning experience. We welcome your feedback. Please contact us at info@torahinmotion.org or at www.torahinmotion.org. Have a great day. Thank you.